Well, welcome, everyone. I'm Dan Palazzolo. I'm a professor of political science and co-director of the Gary L. McDowell Institute, along with my colleague, Terry Price, professor of leadership studies. As many of you probably know, the McDowell Institute at the Jepson School of Leadership Studies is dedicated to free inquiry, thoughtful deliberation, and rigorous discussion of classical texts and issues in political economy. The Institute welcomes members of the university community and beyond, and a wide range of political perspectives. And these are the values that Professor McDowell lived by and modeled as a teacher and a scholar. I want to take a moment, first of all, to recognize and thank a few people. First of all, Dr. Sandra Peer, the Dean of the Jepson School of Leadership Studies. We want to thank her for her continued support and encouragement of the Institute's programs. We're also very grateful to Catherine Rockwell, who's standing up here by the door. Oh, yes.
Wow.
I mean, the applause came before I even asked for it. That's incredible. Seriously, Catherine does an incredible job with the detailed work of planning and executing our events, and that includes today's the events that are surrounding today's speaker. You know, it's interesting. A couple of the student fellows happen to be, mercifully, students in my U.S. Congress class. And we were meeting this morning, and I was getting things together before the class, and the students were talking about, I think, the event today. And one of the students said, "Gee, I got a question." And I said, "Yeah, me too." And they said, "Oh, just ask Catherine. She knows everything." And indeed, she does. So we do want to stop and applaud Dean Peart and Ms. Rockwell. I will just do it again, right? I also want to recognize Gary McDowell's wife, Brenda, who's over there. Brenda is a great friend. She regularly attends our lectures and thoroughly supports our student fellows. And so while you're clapping, you know. None of these people actually wanted any applause or asked for it, but, you know, why not? Seated in the front, we have our student fellows who participate in McDowell Institute events, and they get together biweekly during the spring semester to talk about a selected book, and we'll hear more about that selected book in a few moments. The fellows are led by two terrific faculty members, Dr. Kevin Cherry, who's Associate Professor of Political Science, and Dr. Jessica Flanagan, who's got a lot of titles, so I'm going to get them all in. First of all, Professor. Congratulations, Professor Jessica Flanagan. Professor of Leadership Studies and Philosophy, Politics, Economics, and Law, the alphabet soup known as PPL on our campus, and the Richard L. Morrill Chair in Ethics and Democratic Values. We'll hear more from Professor Flanagan in a moment. Would the fellows and their seminar leaders stand so we can recognize you? Good. Great. Terrific. Finally, we'd like to thank the friends and supporters of the Institute, especially the Pauley Family Foundation, for their generous gifts, which make our programs possible. Just two program notes before we begin. There should be some time at the end of the formal remarks by our speaker for some question and answers. And we will just put up your hand. I will moderate that. Just put up your hands. We'll try to find you. And we typically have microphones that you can ask your question in. And then also, we will have a reception following the event right outside here in the Multert Commons. It will also be an opportunity for you to purchase and get a signed copy of Dr. Hitz's book, Lost in Thought, The Hidden Pleasures of Intellectual Life. Now I'd like to ask Dr. Flanagan if she'd come forward and introduce our speaker. Thank you.
Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for coming out this evening. So as Dr. Palazzolo mentioned, I am Jess. I'm one of the discussion leaders for the McDowell Institute, and I'm here to introduce Dr. Zena Hitz. Zena Hitz is a tutor at St. John's College and the author of Lost in Thought, The Hidden Pleasures of an Intellectual Life, which I would say, just putting it out there, it makes great Christmas and birthday presents, because I've given it to my neighbors, and it's like, it's always a hit, which the Gary McDowell Institute student fellows read over the course of this semester. And reading her work prompted us to consider questions such as, should college professors try to change your life? Or should learning be entertaining? Or is it hypocritical for people at elite institutions to claim that intellectual engagement is really for everyone? And questions like, is intellectual virtue compatible with ambition? Hitz's work was designed to spark these kinds of tricky and searching conversations that can go on forever. She's a true public intellectual. Like the great books that she teaches at St. John's, her own writing is both accessible to everyone and yet deep and engaging enough to sustain a semester-long seminar or a lifetime of learning. Hitz has also recently written A Philosopher Looks at Religious Life, where she reflects on her experiences living in a Christian religious community, as well as the experience of monks, nuns, friars, and hermits. And there she aims to spark other important questions and conversations by asking things like, what is happiness? Does life have meaning? And if so, is meaning available in an ordinary life? And so hopefully you are all already thinking about these, but you're going to think about them in such a much more deep and rich and engaging way after hearing Dr. Hitz speak today about her work, Lost in Thought. It is my hope that our conversation will inspire everyone here to have more and better conversations about these important life-changing topics and conversations. So please join us, the Dairy McDowell students who have already read Dr. Hitz's work, in this big conversation about the big questions. And to start it off, please join me in welcoming Dr. Zena Hitz to talk about Lost in Thought. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Jessica, for that very beautiful, flattering introduction. I do want to say a few words, because I've been here for about 48 hours, and I've been scheduled with 48 hours of activities. And they've been in advance, not having been here before. I was a little daunted, and I've just had a delightful time. All of my meetings have been so fun and so interesting. And I'm so impressed with the students and with the administrators and with the teachers and with the community here. And, you know, as I've said, as, you know, remarked in passing since I've been here, I haven't dwelt on it, but I think it's hard times for people, humanist educators, and it's really means a lot to be in a place where things are flourishing. It gives me hope. So I'm gonna try to go away and share some of the hope before it's crushed by some other new catastrophe. So I did want to just thank my hosts for their wonderful hospitality and for reading my book so carefully and for all the conversations. And I'm happy to end it off with this last conversation, where I'll get a chance to develop some of my thoughts for those of you who haven't read it. And also I'll bring out a theme from the book, which is not obvious for those of you who have been reading it all semester or who had to read it last year and then this year with your class. And the theme I'm going to be bringing out of the book that's not so explicit in it is the idea of freedom. So the type of education that I'm promoting is sometimes called liberal learning, liberal education. And that has, as we all know, nothing to do with politics, but to do with an education that makes people free. So I use some of the stories and themes of Lost in Thought in my talk tonight to try to get at this question of what kind of freedom do we think we'd be cultivating with education? And yet, what does it look like? As with all these questions, it's impossible to exhaust them. So I'm going to toss out some stories and examples and some questions and some arguments, and then it will be up to each of you audience members to take them in your own direction. Okay, so I thought I'd begin by asking you a question, each of you individually. It's addressed especially at students, but you're not all students. Some of your community members have to find a way to adapt it. But I think everyone has a version of this kind of question. So many or most of you are students. Why are you studying? Why did you enroll in the course that you're in? Why go to college or graduate school in general? Why study the particular subject you have chosen to study. If you're a community member working in the world, or a faculty member, administrator at the college, how did you get into this line of work? Are you still doing the thing that you thought you were doing? Why do it this way and not another way? But back to the students, since this is a university and it's all about the students originally. I'll guess that some of you are quite confident either of the usefulness of your studies for some desirable project, a career, a life of work, or you may be confident in the value that your study has for you personally. That is, you might love what you're learning for its own sake. So some of you, I think, might be very confident, like, I know what I'm doing, I chose the major that I wanted to do because I know exactly what I want to do, and I put exactly the right amount of learning for its own sake in, or I'm studying for its own sake and that's all I've ever done. But others, I'm going to guess, are not going to be quite so confident. It's very possible and very common to go to college or graduate school or choose a course of study or choose a line of work on a kind of autopilot. Everyone you know does it. Everyone like us does it. Everyone around you does it. It just seems normal. And I'm guessing that most of you, like me, have some mix of these kinds of motivations. There's an autopilot that kind of runs on its own, and it sometimes results in uneasiness, like, do I really want this? How did I get here? Who am I anyway? So that you have that kind of motivation on the other hand. On the other hand, you might have a focused passion, which sometimes results in anxiety. What am I sacrificing to do this? Is it really worth it? So I think it's important for everyone to examine their motivations for learning or for anything else for reasons that I will explain. But certainly, if one wants to live an intellectual life, as the title of the book promises, or if one wants something called freedom, as the term liberal education suggests, it's strictly necessary to look honestly at what's making you tick. And so to provoke your thinking, I'll bring in some examples of modes of learning that look to me very unusual or even extraordinary. Okay, so here's the first one. The Russian dissident Irina Ratushinskaya used poetry as a form of resistance during her imprisonment by the Soviet authorities in the early 1980s. On the transport train to the prison, at any point of contact with other prisoners, she would recite poems, original or classic. Memorized poems were written out on scraps of paper and exchanged between prisoners. When she was denied writing materials, she scratched her poems onto bars of soap with matchsticks, washing them away after she had memorized them. She transferred them to cigarette paper when she could, and they were smuggled out of prison to be published in the West. The medievalist scholar Irina Dumitrescu writes about Romanian political prisoners around the same time period in the Soviet era, who taught each other Morse code and tapped out poetry through the walls between their cells. Some taught each other languages, one using knots on a piece of string to code letters. One Romanian officer in Siberia made ink out of blackberries and wrote out French poems he'd memorized in school. More than one prisoner of this kind referred to their time in prison as a university. So one might think that the pursuit of poetry, philosophy, or languages in prison as a safeguard for one's dignity or a bond of connection between one person and another is a rather special form of intellectual life, very unusual, kind of a hothouse flower, nothing very relevant to the rest of it. But there are a multitude of parallel examples from differing political, religious, and historical contexts. And that suggests to me that there's something more going on in these stories. So here are a few more examples. André Weil, the mathematician and brother of Simone Weil, the philosopher, was imprisoned by the Vichy government for refusing to serve in the army. This is the early 1940s. While in prison, he undertook a major mathematical proof, the Riemann hypothesis for curves under finite fields. He joked that only in prison could he have achieved such results. The African-American activist Malcolm X entered prison as a man named Malcolm Little, a defiant hedonist, addicted to drugs, reliant on petty crime. His father had been murdered by white men when he was a child, and his family subsequently broken up by the local welfare office. Long studies in the prison library and conversations with a self-educated inmate changed him. Malcolm began to read, first the dictionary from start to finish, then books on etymology and linguistics. He studied elementary Latin and German. He converted to Islam, a faith introduced to him by his brothers. In the following years, he read the Bible, the Quran, Nietzsche, Schopenhauer, Spinoza, and Kant, as well as works of Asian philosophy. He pored over an especially loved book of archaeological wonders of the East and West. He learned the history of colonialism, slavery, and of African peoples. He felt his old ways of thinking disappear, in his language, like snow off a roof. He left prison as a minister in the Nation of Islam, and as a powerful spokesman for the African American communities that had been most beaten down by poverty and violence, the violence fed by racial prejudice. So examples of the flourishing of intellectual life in social isolation and relative poverty extend far past prison walls. So consider the ordinary young bookworm who retreats from the slings and arrows of social life, the high school cafeteria, for instance, to learn, to think, to ponder, and to imagine. Or at a different level, think of the case of Albert Einstein. He was unable to find an academic job. And when there are graduate students present, I don't know how many there are here today, but I always like to remind them that Albert Einstein didn't get an academic job. He took a job in a patent office instead. It was in that office, isolated from academic contacts, that he wrote the three 1905 papers that turned physics upside down. He called it, these are his words, the worldly cloister, the patent office. The worldly cloister where I hatched all my most beautiful ideas. Or consider John Baker, who was a lover of literature without a college degree, who worked at an office job at the Automobile Association of Essex. This is the British equivalent of AAA. In his spare time, he stalked peregrine falcons over Essex by bicycle for 10 years, carrying maps, taking voluminous notes, before consolidating his work into the 1967 poetic masterpiece, The Peregrine. The men and women I have described pursued intellectual activity outside of universities with an intensity that's not always found within them. I'm gonna open up the water bottle in a second. As the case of Malcolm X illustrates, the life of the mind is not only a retreat or refuge from difficult or dehumanizing realities. It's a source of transformation. And on this, consider the ancient testimony of Augustine's Confessions. Augustine has, early in the book, the perfect life, promising career, a loving concubine, the prospect of a wealthy wife to advance his prospects. He belongs to the cult of the Manichaeans, which permits him a cosmic worldview that excuses him from his moral responsibility for his sexual compulsions, as he sees it. He's schooled in this Baroque metaphysics of the Manichaeans, and he wins many victories and arguments over ignorant Christians. But a course of serious reading in philosophy bores holes in his comfortable lifestyle. And it leads to the collapse of the whole edifice. So after this 10-year course of reading, he converts to Christianity, gives up both sex and his prestigious career. Everyone remembers the first part. People don't always remember the second part. He gives up a really, really nice-looking career. And after that, seeks out a life of philosophical retreat. The Christian parallel to the studious prisoners takes its most famous form in the images of the Virgin Mary at the arrival of the angel Gabriel, called the Annunciation. And I wish I had some images. They're very beautiful paintings, but you could Google images, Mary Annunciation painting, and you'll see what I'm talking about quite quickly. In a tradition dating from the second century and influencing Christian art and literature through the Renaissance, Mary was a bookworm, an avid reader, especially of the Holy Scriptures. She's sometimes pictured with a small book, that's very common. But there are also some paintings where you see her in a study that's stacked high, like she's in the middle of a major project. Her reading symbolizes her wisdom, and so the freedom with which she consents to bear the Messiah. Her enclosed or sheltered surroundings symbolize the ascetic cost of that wisdom. It grows in silence, in solitude, in deprivation, and in sacrifice. The bookworm's escape, the thoughtful prisoners, the isolated bird watcher, evoke Catholic and Orthodox Christian contemplative traditions. The desert retreat, the platform on the pillar. This is true for those of you who don't know that there were saints who lived on the tops of pillars. I find it very appealing, but maybe not for everyone. The cell of the monk or the nun. The Christian versions of poverty, failure, and confinement have an unavoidably supernatural character. They depict the communion of the individual soul with the transcendent God who creates and redeems. But forms of asceticism are found in a broad range of global religious traditions with different theological premises. Asceticism, as such, has a basis in our human elements. It's necessary in many practices to have some form of discipline and sacrifice to cultivate what's best in us. And that's thanks to the corrosive impact of wealth and status and other the corrosive impact of wealth, status, and other less romantic goods on our motivations. And by what is best in us, when I say asceticism is necessary to cultivate what's best in us, I don't just mean intellectual excellence. I mean primarily the ability to recover one's dignity from the common diminishments of social life and to form communities with others on the basis of dignity rather than on the basis of social use. Such dignity and community are by no means reserved only to Einsteins or to brilliant poetic dissidents. They are a common human heritage. So I've described some unusual examples of people who lead an intellectual life, a life in which the love of learning is exercised for its own sake. Cultivating that love and training its exercise is what is called by the old-fashioned name of liberal learning. It includes, but not exclusively, the humanities, the studies of human beings in literature, philosophy, history, political theory, and so on. But mathematics and science can also be pursued for their own sake. And so my interest is more broad than just the humanities themselves. What makes the love of learning for its own sake any different from, say, the love of sports for its own sake, the love of walking in the woods for its own sake, or making model ships out of toothpicks for its own sake? That may seem kind of off, but for those of you who've been up to Baltimore to the Visionary Arts Museum, there's this magnificent model of the Lusitania made out of toothpicks. I saw it years ago, and it's just stuck emblazoned in my mind as an example of something majestic that someone could do with their mind. Okay. So what makes the love of learning for its own sake any different from these other activities which seem to be sought for their own sake and which seem to be a way of escaping from the world in their own way? The term liberal learning, despite appearances, I don't think has anything to do with liberalism either classic or contemporary. It means a kind of learning that liberates, that cultivates a kind of freedom. Now, in what sense do the human beings I've described display freedom? After all, most of them that I've talked about have been prisoners, and all have highly restricted choices. It's a strange kind of freedom that a prisoner could keep, or even that a prisoner, even weirder, stranger, a kind that a prisoner might have special access to. So, I mean, what would count as unfreedom? What would count as compulsion? What would count as slavery if these people are free? So I want to come around to this question by thinking about how the life of the mind in these examples differs from the way that we find it depicted in our mainstream university culture. Consider the force I describe as autopilot. You go to college, then to grad school, or master's program, MBA program, because everyone you know is doing it. You belong to a social group or a social class, you do what they do. Or you aspire to be in that social group or social class, you do what they do. That's not a bad thing in and of itself, but it has to be looked at with some care. Education is necessary for most forms of work that bring either money, that is a comfortable lifestyle, or a certain kind of social status. Now, sometimes this more straightforward motivation for a comfortable lifestyle or for social status is taken up honestly, and sometimes it hides behind grander conceptions. So I've removed all the names and titles from the following, but consider some research titles from a prestigious academic center at a top research university. Here's one, Converting the Patterns of Nature and the Human Body into Beneficial Signals and Energy. Designing Wearable Systems for Cognitive Enhancement. Advancing Justice in Earth's Complex Systems Using Designs Enabled by Space. You're allowed to laugh, they're funny, I think. The flavor of these titles is gimmicky and slick. It has a kind of sound of sophistication, but when you try to understand what's being said, you can't get at it. It's not obvious whether any life would be improved by these projects, much less a community. So assuming I'm right about this and that there isn't something in these projects that's beyond my expertise that I never understood, where do these things come from? They come from money to prestige via the language of the media splash, the public relations coup. It sounds good to a certain kind of wealthy person or a certain kind of audience, and so it exists. Now, there's a more common and perhaps less obviously sinister example of the ways in which straightforward desires for money and status can hide behind what seem like grander motivations. And that's the more common and less obviously sinister, I think, is the growth of what sociologist David Graeber calls bullshit jobs. I could say BS jobs. I don't know how. What's your vote? Like, okay. For some reason, shockingly, I think that was Dr. Flanagan. I don't know. Is that surprising? She wants me to go for it. I sometimes use BS when I'm in the more tender audiences, but okay. So such work involves pretending to do something important, where in fact no tangible good is produced. Now this book was produced, I don't actually much like the sociological analysis he has, but he wrote a short piece online about it and then got hundreds of letters from all over the world from people who had jobs like this. And so the best part of the book is the collection of these stories from real people who have real jobs like this. So one example is a subcontractor to a subcontractor to the German military. And his job is to drive long distances to move furniture from one room to another and to handle the proper paperwork. There's a very poignant story of a man who's, this is probably the best story in the book, at least my favorite, a man who's hired to patch a problem that the higher authorities in the company don't actually want fixed. So there's two leaders of the company. One of them wants it fixed, the other one doesn't. And the compromise they have is to hire someone not to fix it. So he's paid, and paid well, and he has a fancy title, to do nothing. He starts off like reading novels, he starts drinking at work, starts taking phony work trips, and tries to get himself fired. Finally, he tries to resign, he gets offered a raise. His job is a necessary pretense for his superiors. They cannot let him go. And what's fascinating about these stories is, I mean, it's a funny story, but it's also a kind of horrible story, because what's fascinating about the stories he collects is these people are deeply unhappy. They're deeply unhappy, despite the fact that they have money and status. So these are bullshit job is a high-paid job with a high status. He distinguishes them from what he calls shit jobs, which are jobs which really matter, but which are paid badly. Okay, home health care worker, food service worker, like crucial jobs, like absolutely important, but not respected in society. So a bullshit job is always a high prestige, high pay job. So these workers have money and status, but they have no work. They have no service that is assigned to them. And it seems like they really long for real work and real service and for connection with their communities. So research that entertains a certain kind of wealthy person or a certain kind of consultancy group, or work that creates an appearance of productivity, these are central examples of the unfreedom that liberal learning seeks to counter. If you work in these contexts, your work is for the ends of others. You are not a mere cog in the machine. Okay, like your classic Adam Smith examples of someone who makes a particular kind of nail in the nail factory. Okay, that person's a cog in the machine, but that nail does some good to something somewhere. So it has its role in the common good. A bullshit job is much worse than that, because what you're doing actually has no such role. You're worse than a cog in the machine. You're being used to create an appearance that makes someone money. And it seems to me that no salary and no degree of social standing could compensate for that kind of human diminishment. So it's much more dignified, although less lucrative and less prestigious, to pursue training for work that serves an evident need in a human community. Learning how to build homes and offices, to build bridges or roads, to make our communities safe, sanitary, comfortable, or beautiful. That's training to fill a real need. Those are things that human beings actually need. Likewise, training in medical care, whether engineering, surgery, basic assistance, it helps a person to contribute to the community. Our communities would collapse without this kind of work, and many, many other useful kinds of work, such as collecting waste or collecting garbage, even though they don't require much training, are absolutely essential. I should say even when they don't require much training. It might actually require a lot of training to collect garbage, I'm not sure. Okay. So despite the overwhelming importance of useful work like this, so you have an advantage over a person with a bullshit job in that you have meaningful work. But as those of you who've read the rest of my book know, I'll say, you're not living it's not sufficient for a full human life. So if these things are all that we do, we run the risk of being functionaries, that is, members of a community. Oh, sorry. You're helping the community run without being real members of it. So we can work for the ends of others without receiving the goods that we produce ourselves. So think of a home healthcare aide who cannot afford health insurance. So that's someone who's serving the goods of the community, but is not fully a member of the community. The truth is that we are exposed to different professions and professional training without reference to the ultimate good that they serve. Or should I say, without careful thinking about the good that they serve. Am I building an apartment complex for people to live in? Or am I building an investment complex that'll make the investors money while the market's high, but will be left an empty, half-finished eyesore in a matter of months? One form of building serves the common good, the other does not. Is the healthcare I'm learning to practice focused on healing the sick, improving the lives of those with disabilities, providing comfort to the elderly, or is it a form of cosmetics or eugenics for some people to distinguish themselves from others? Liberal learning of the kind that I'm interested in was conceived and developed in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, when the large and growing class of laborers and immigrants sought to improve their lives by appropriating to themselves the learning of the aristocrats through the great books and the classics. They were aided by printing technology that permitted the mass market paperback, a vast industry in translating classics into English, that is in the UK and the US. That meant that books reserved for centuries to a few suddenly became accessible to anyone who could read. Working men and women in the UK and the US, starting in the late 18th century up through the mid 20th century, formed clubs and groups, formal and informal, to educate themselves and one another on fundamental human questions. They sought citizenship and political rights, as well as greater economic freedom. But they also sought learning for its own sake, to escape from the diminishments of factory work or other servile labor. So these movements, which I've always been very interested in, one of the things that they illustrate to me is not just that there's the desire for learning can be very fierce, it can persevere in very tough, difficult circumstances, and it can be recognized by people who live lives which are meaningful, that is, you're doing work that matters. You're a bricklayer, you're a mechanic, you work in a factory, but it leaves you as an individual with your own good and benefit and dignity left a bit bereft. So these people, they did their work, and then in their spare time, such as they had it, they built these movements and these communities where they recovered their dignity, where they thought about big questions, where they thought about what justice was, what a human being was, whether or not there was a God. There's a beautiful passage, Jonathan Rose, who's the historian who I know best, who's studied these groups. He has a passage from a British group where they had an amateur astronomy society. And these groups have a legacy now. There turn out to be hundreds of amateur astronomy societies in the United States. It's the kind of thing you don't really necessarily know about, but it's there. So anyway, I feel like these stories are very fruitful for us in thinking about what if we feel, as I sometimes feel, that our institutions aren't necessarily serving our deepest needs for learning, what kinds of solutions are available to us? Liberal learning, learning for freedom, relies on the principle that I am most free when I exist for my own sake, when I have in mind my own development. I am most free when I choose the ends for which I work, where I'm not simply following along an autopilot track laid by someone else. So I want to hypothesize that this is the freedom that liberal education seeks to cultivate. Now, why is the freedom that I have tried to outline, the freedom to live for one's own sake, to pursue a meaningful life, to consider the value of one's own ends, of one's own development, why is it something difficult? So why did I start out this talk talking about asceticism and sacrifice? Why is it rare, such that one achieves it maybe only in prison or after a catastrophic failure like Einstein's to get a job? Or why does it flourish under these conditions, post-industrial revolution of workers, which, like, if you read about them now, kind of shock the conscience. But the life of the mind grew in this kind of soil. So here's my thought about why this freedom is so difficult. It's brief, but it's a thought. Instrumental tasks like those I have described have a kind of enchanting effect. They are mere means to an end, and their value depends absolutely on that end. So instrumental tasks like working for the sake of money, that's the kind of instrumental task. I feel like a paragraph must have fallen out of the talk somewhere, honestly, because the instrumental task, I think, hasn't come up before. Okay, so instrumental tasks or instrumental work or going on autopilot has a kind of enchanting effect. So their means to ends, their value tends totally on the ends. So if your work doesn't serve the common good, if it's just a way to, like, get the paycheck at the end of the day, but what you're doing actually doesn't matter, what you're doing doesn't make any sense, right? It's meaningless. So the instrumental tasks can be exercised with ingenuity and verve, and they can seem valuable in themselves. And so too, if they're lavished with money and prestige, we might convince ourselves that they are the best that there is. So the danger, I want to say, is something like this. Either we use ourselves as vehicles of wealth and prestige, insofar as we can achieve it, or that we innocently serve the selfish or destructive ends of others, like when we work in jobs where the benefit is only to our employers and not to ourselves. And this, I want to say, is the unfreedom, the compulsion or the slavery that our initial intellectuals have escaped. So I have a little bit of time, so I'm just going to go back and try to walk through what I just said. I began by asking you why all of you were doing whatever you were doing. And I suggested that there might be two ways, at least, of doing it. One, autopilot, and one, a kind of passionate engagement. And thirdly, the most common, the maybe universal, the mixture of the two. And I suggested that it might be worthwhile to try to figure out which of those things was really at the bottom of what you were doing. So I then brought up these examples. Irina Rakhshinskaya, Andre Vey, Malcolm X, Albert Einstein, John Baker, the Peregrine Watcher. These are people who show through their poverty and their suffering the value of the thing that they're chasing, that is poetry, the study of nature, mathematics, or in Malcolm X's case, I mean, he read almost everything, all the history and political theory and languages and philosophy that and linguistics that you could think of. These people seem to be doing something out of an impassioned commitment, and they seem to rescue their dignity from the ways in which it's endangered by their environment. Okay, so the thought of using these examples, again, is that there's nothing more diminishing to a person's dignity than a deliberate deprivation of it, right? And that's what's certainly happening to Irina Rakhshinskaya in Siberia. Her captors want to break the will of their inmates. They want to diminish all of their dignity, and they want to do that in order to control them better. And they fail because of these inner resources that these people have. I then talked about the ways in which there's a parallel structure in Christian spirituality, where there's a kind of sacrifice for a higher transcendent good, and also how asceticism or sacrifice is essential even in kind of garden variety ways of life. So one can't become a great athlete, one can't become a great artist, one can't become a musician without the deliberate and voluntary choice of various kinds of pain and suffering and restriction. So there's something about asceticism and sacrifice which is necessary. And the reason why it's necessary is what I've just been pointing to at the end. That is that the autopilot is the default position. It has a force of its own. Doing tasks, whether because of the social pressure or because we'd rather not face our deepest motivations, because we're afraid that we'll discover something about ourselves that we don't want to discover, because we fear the kind of chaos or conflict that will result if we recognize them. For that reason, the pressure is all towards the autopilot, and it takes effort and discipline and sacrifice to cultivate the other thing. So just as one can't become an athlete without being willing to restrict one's diet and restrict one's time and suffer a certain amount of pain and risk of injury, one can't develop the fullest riches of dignity and the life of the mind and the pursuit of what's best in human life without without really trying to resist that autopilot drift. And I've described that the escape from the autopilot as a kind of liberation. And I've suggested that that kind of freedom is the object of liberal education. So with that, I will draw my remarks to a conclusion and open up the floor for conversations. Thank you so much.
A student, as you can see. The topic was very interesting. I come from the healthcare, so I had the immediate rewards that you mentioned in where I saw the value of my work.
Yeah.
But what would you recommend to the young people now? So make sure you go off, you don't get into the autopilot, and how do you juggle that with the need of supporting yourself in this society?
That's a wonderful question. My thought is that the dichotomy is too stark. So it's true that my examples are people who are at sort of the bottom of the social ladder where no one should aspire to be a prisoner, no one should aspire to work in a factory where they make only a nail. What these people have that is worth aspiring to is inner resources and imagination and a sense of their own value and a sense that it seems more likely in those circumstances that you can see things clearly that are not going right in your social environment, right? That's why sometimes they become activists or visionaries of some kind. So the point is to, first of all, I've spend some time with the students, so I think they know that I'm not judging them. You have to be aware of the autopilot. That's the first thing. Like, you have to recognize that it is a thing that can happen to you, and that happens in some way to everyone. And then to try to discover in yourself, well, where are the authentic motivations? Where are the motivations that are more fulfilling to you, where you can recognize some good that you're achieving for yourself or for others? And then to live in that tension, you know, until you see the right way. But I don't think it's true that the autopilot is the only path to success. In fact, it might be a terrible path to success. When I was young, everyone went to law school if they were ambitious. And then there started not being any law jobs, 5 years ago, everyone went into coding, right? And now the coding is drying up. So the autopilot is actually not a great way of success either. So to the extent that education's for success, I think you want people to be creative, in touch with reality, in touch with the deepest parts of themselves. That requires this kind of at least awareness and cultivation of other kinds of things. Then, I mean, it's also true, and this is the other part of my argument, that we shouldn't just be educating for success. In a way, we can't. Not because it's bad, but because we can't. Because we can't guarantee success. So I think the beautiful thing about liberal education is that it really is an education for success. It really does cultivate creativity and imagination that fuels innovation and critical thinking that makes the world run better. But it also is there for you when everything goes wrong. It's hard for me to see young people or older people who have never imagined that everything will go wrong. So we need to imagine it. No one wants it. No one should choose it. And then to build resources for yourself that are going to be there even in those circumstances. Thanks for your question. So I want, on the one hand, to agree with you that the sense that we lack time is extremely pervasive for students and for older people. Like, there's no time, right? I do think that the way this is talked about in traditional theories of liberal education, going back to Plato and Aristotle, is what's needed for real learning and real thinking is leisure. So leisure doesn't just mean free time, it doesn't just mean, you know, time at the beach, time doing nothing, but time that isn't dedicated to means to end things, but where you're doing things that matter in and of themselves. So you might be leisurely in this sense to be working on a really hard mathematical proof or piece of philosophy, even though it's quite hard work, because you're not doing it for any reason than but for what it is in itself. And this is an interesting fact because this is the heritage of the aristocratic version of liberal learning. So, you know, Plato and Aristotle, not being like us in many ways, they thought, well, the only people that can do this are people who never do manual labor, so it'll be for the aristocrats. One of the things that I think is so beautiful about these stories about the grassroots intellectual movements that happened in the late 18th, 19th, 20th century is that once you had mass literacy and an interest in mass literacy, possibility and interest in it, and suddenly you find people who work with their hands who have the leisure to do it. Not in the sense that they don't have to work. That's an impossible standard for virtually everyone now. But in the sense that they can take some time, some space away from work to cultivate themselves. So you have these beautiful self-help books from the beginning of the 20th century. There's one on called How to Live on 24 Hours a Day. I think it's a great title. There's another one called The Intellectual Life. And they have these kinds of schemes for how, as a working person, you can cultivate the life of the mind. 2 hours a day, or 45 minutes twice a week, or they have various schemes you could imagine. So I think it is possible. I don't think it's impossible. I don't think it's true that we don't have the time. I think it's true that we don't feel like we have the time. And part of that pressure is this autopilot pressure. And the sense, so that's more of a psychological explanation. Like, we don't really want to stop, right, and think. So Pascal says that there's nothing harder than sitting alone in an empty room, right? Like, nothing is more horrible to the modern person than that. And there's something in that for us, too. So that's part of the ascetical sacrifice. So I want to say that, and then I do also just, sorry to keep talking for one question, but I don't think it's all efficiency. So I think the language of efficiency is a bit of a smokescreen. So I think the whole interesting thing to me about the growth of the bullshit jobs is that something about efficiency has gone wrong. You're creating more work without doing things better. In fact, things might be going worse. I don't know why that is. I'm not a economist, behavioral economist of any kind. I have no idea. But I think it's important not to to be a bit skeptical about thinking that we're all moving towards greater efficiency. I think sometimes it moves towards efficiency and sometimes goes in the opposite direction. Why, I don't know. Anyway, thank you so much for your question.
Why did Rose pick Oppenheimer?
It sounds like you have an answer to that question. You have to answer it yourself.
Oppenheimer was a widely educated man. Everyone was against the choice. Rose was right.
Yes, so I think that seems to be supporting the idea that the liberal education, the broad education, makes you more effective at doing things. It helps you to, and you can, I mean, sorry, I mean, it's from the film. I don't know anything about Oppenheimer, apart from what I saw in the film. He figures out how to do this, right? He's like, oh, I've got some land in New Mexico. We always go to that. Let's do that. So he has this imagination. And he also, I think, this might be a little bit off to the side, but he understands something of the moral gravity of what he's doing. And you might disagree, you know, you might think he did the wrong thing, he shouldn't have done it. I have some instinct in that direction. But I'd rather someone did it who had that awareness, even if it didn't win out in the end, than someone who didn't have that awareness. And the use of Sanskrit in the movie, right, the I've become death destroyer of worlds, that's a sign of someone, that the moral awareness is being articulated through these classic books. So I'm going to riff off that. So thanks for the suggestion of Oppenheimer.
Yeah, Tom, just one more.
Thank you. There may be a problem in using very eminent people as role models, because all of us aren't Einstein or Oppenheimer or Descartes. I'd like to hear your opinion on that.
No, it's a wonderful point. And it's the bind I was in. So the thesis, like the spirit of my work is the life of the mind is for everyone, right? But when I'm looking around for examples, who are the books written about? Who are the stories come from? Well, normally pretty well-known people. So I do, in the book I try, like there's a couple of fictional examples or anecdotal examples, since the book has come out, like, people send me emails with their own examples, you know, their uncle who was an auto mechanic who knew everything about Shakespeare, you know, their parents who, you know, never went to college but, you know, recited poetry or whatever. So, you know, I know it's true, but those in a way are kind of private examples, right? You can't. So anyway, it's easier to write about famous people. And it does illustrate the other more conventional part of my argument, right? The conventional part of my argument is kind of the Oppenheimer argument, that you're more creative and more successful when you do this. But the more interesting part, which you've fixed on, is to me also, is that this is for everyone. Yeah, I just had to use the examples of people there were books about. That's my excuse. Thank you for the question. I wait for the mics coming to you, because they won't be able to hear you in the back.
Thank you. So we talked a lot in our discussion today about, with living an intellectual life, how much of that has to be isolationist versus community.
Yes.
And then you talked a lot about the autopilot here.
Yeah.
So you published the book that we read in 2020. So I was wondering, post-COVID, have you seen any changes in how students and people are pursuing an intellectual life after having that autopilot disrupted a bit?
That's a really great question. I think there have been some positive developments. So I think when you had that enforced imprisonment, so to speak, you know, you had, I don't want to laugh diminishing, you know, the incarcerated, but, you know, you're trapped in your house and your social interaction is very limited. And there was obviously a huge amount of reflection on the point of what they did. So that's one of the reasons why you hit this mass, like everyone quits their jobs, right? Like, and then there's kind of these new little enterprises that you're just starting to see come to the surface because it takes a while. So there's some of that. And I think I'll tell you something else, because this is one of the most wonderful things about college students I've seen in the past 4 years. When we first went on emergency online teaching, Zoom teaching, I was absolutely terrified because I thought, this is so much cheaper than a regular classroom. Like, all the powers that be, the administrators, no offense to the beautiful people in the front, I know you wouldn't do this, but they're going to see the bottom line, and we're never going to have in-person classes or universities again. Like, this will destroy the colleges and universities. And the thing that prevented that from happening, I mean, to some extent, like, online learning has spread since then, and I think that's bad. But what prevented that from happening was college students. So, you know, they hated it. They hated the Zoom teaching, and they made that clear. They told that to everyone. There were lawsuits who claimed that, like, these credits, this tuition wasn't worth the same as it was in person. Like, the pressure went on. And that, I think, was also a really encouraging sign that, you know, like, when all you have is your screens, like, it's more clear that there can't be the sum and source of the meaning of your life. So, yeah, there have been some encouraging developments since then. So, yeah, thanks for the question.
And there's hope for higher education after all.
Yes. Thanks to Richmond. Thank you.